It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we learn why being kind to ourselves is more than needless pampering. It's actually important for our physical and mental health. First, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, or WCIJ, found that the Wisconsin DNR took months to update lead testing guidelines from the EPA in the wake of the Flint, Michigan water crisis. The WCIJ also found that gaps in the state's enforcement of federal drinking water standards left many schools and daycare facilities vulnerable. Dee Hall is with us now. She's managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, the Flint water crisis was huge news in the last year, but even as that Flint story was happening, Wisconsin was facing its own drinking water troubles, and you wrote about this in your series, Failure at the Faucet. What do you see as the top concerns here in Wisconsin coming out of that investigation?
So we did a multi-part series that began just over a year ago, looking at the different contaminants that we face in Wisconsin, and we found various places where nitrates a problem, bacteria, strontium, pesticides, radium, all kinds of problems with our water. Lead is the one that it turned out that our story came out right about the time that the nation was sort of waking up to the crisis in Flint. And that's one where we found a lot of gaps there, mostly on the federal level, that the requirements of the lead and copper rule, which are the rules under which the drinking water systems operate, really are not set up to protect public health.
Tell us a little bit more about that. What don't they do?
Well, one of the best example I can use is the city of Milwaukee. The city of Milwaukee is in compliance with the lead and copper rule. It is required to only test 50 locations every third year to figure out whether they comply. What we found out, of course, is that that is very inadequate in a community that has 70,000 lead service lines. Just recently, I think within the past 2 weeks, the Milwaukee Public Schools tested hundreds or thousands, actually, of different water sources within the school system. They found 183 drinking water fountains had dangerously high levels of lead. So obviously that's within the city of Milwaukee, a city that complies with the lead and copper rule.
Now, looking at Flint once more, I mean, that's the example people point to and say, look, that's a city with a very serious problem. They did all kinds of things wrong. How does Wisconsin compare to Flint?
So when you look at the thing that alarmed people in Flint was that, of course, there was lead in the water. And what they discovered was that the percentage of children testing as having lead poisoning doubled in the time frame during which the new water source was entering Flint and creating the problem and scouring out the lead service lines and other lead in their system. What's interesting, though, is Flint had about 4.9% of its children who were tested were lead poisoned, which was double what it had been. Milwaukee is over 8% right now. And the state of Wisconsin is at about 4.5%. So we're not, in terms of the tested children, we're not much better than Flint as a state.
And in some cases, worse.
Yes. In the case of Milwaukee, there a higher percentage of the children who are tested are lead poisoned. Now, I will tell you that the State Department of Health Services will say they've never found a single child who's been lead poisoned because of water. But what we discovered in our stories is that that's because they are not required to test the water when a child comes up lead poisoned. So it's a chicken and an egg situation. You're not going to find it if you're not looking for it.
So we'll talk in more depth and in a little bit about what problems schools face. But, I mean, what does happen right now if a child does test high with lead content in their blood?
Well, right now, what would happen is if they're very high, there would be an investigation into the possible sources of lead poisoning. But the only ones that are mandated to be looked at are paint, for example. That is considered to be the primary source. And, in fact, it may be the primary source. But what we're finding is that there's no requirement that so-called secondary sources like water and soil, that they be tested as well. And so what we found is just a gap in the protection of children when it comes to lead.
Walk us through, if you would, again, how lead gets into the drinking water in the first place.
So lead comes from a bunch of different places. It all has to do with interior plumbing. It is not generally in the water source at the water plant. So that's not where the lead comes in. The lead comes in once it leaves the water plant and goes through either lead service lines, which are the lines that go from the middle, from the water main to the home, Or once they get into the home, there are places, even soldering that joins two pipes together, that can have lead in it, and that can put lead into your water. In addition, there are old faucets that have lead in them. So those are the main sources. And what communities do, including Milwaukee, is they put something called corrosion control in the water, and it is set up to sort of bind any lead, if there is any lead in your pipes, to bind them to the pipes and keep them from flaking off and coming into the water. The problem that has been discovered, however, is that doesn't completely safeguard people from lead in water.
Dee Hall is with us in studio right now. She's managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We're looking back at the WCIJ's investigations into Wisconsin's drinking water, the quality, and what sorts of contaminants may be in Wisconsin's drinking water supply. And Dee, before we go any further, what are the dangers of lead? What happens once lead does enter the human body?
Well, it's particularly dangerous to pregnant women. There have been associated higher levels of miscarriage if you're pregnant and drinking water that has a lot of lead in it. For infants and for young children, it can lead to developmental delays, both physical and mental, behavior problems, even later criminality have all been tied to being lead poisoned as a child. So it's a very, very serious problem.
And overall, I mean, you produced a number of pieces about this from lots of different angles over the course of 2016. What kind of response did you get?
Well, I think that policymakers are starting to wake up to this notion that it's not just a Flint problem. The State Department of Natural Resources implemented a new program, which they've never had before, to help communities replace their lead service lines. There are at least 176,000 lead service lines in Wisconsin leading to homes and businesses. That's a very conservative estimate because a lot of places don't know how many they have. Beyond that, you've had some proposals in the legislature. They haven't gone anywhere yet, but the proposals to lower the level at which a child who's lead poisoned is gets some help from the state or the local county health department or the local health department. In addition, there was a proposal, which also didn't go anywhere in the legislature, but to require that water be tested when a child is lead poisoned to try to close that loop and figure out, are any of our lead poisoning cases due to, and there are thousands of them a year, are any of them due to water?
And I know that the testing itself can be tricky. We talked about this in the past year, that it's not so simple as opening the tap and you get a reading that's good and so you just move on. It's complicated.
Yes, it's very complicated. In fact, you could take 12 water samples, which would be a common, you know, number from the same tap and, you know, 11 of them can come out to be perfectly like no detection or very low levels of lead, and then you can have one spike there that shows an unsafe level of lead. And it's because it doesn't come off in a predictable fashion. It can flake off. And so you really can't say, even if you don't detect lead in the water, that there's no lead in the water. A single one-time test cannot tell you that.
And another story, this one's a little more recent, out from the WCIJ, began with some results at a report from West Middleton Elementary School in Dane County, where there were some troubling findings. Well, what's the latest with that?
So what that story focused on is the gap that exists when it comes to schools and daycares. So schools and daycares are not, unless they operate their own water system, which is a pretty unusual circumstance that West Middleton happens to be in, you know, they are not required to test. So what happens is a community like Wausau, for example, which has a municipal water system, most of the schools are not required to test their water. The municipality tests, but they're not required to use schools as one of the test sites. And so there are some moves on the federal level to make that a requirement of the lead and copper rule, that a community goes and tests all of its schools. When that's happened, what we've seen is, as I mentioned, the city of Milwaukee or the Milwaukee Public Schools came up with, you know, nearly 200 water fountains that had unsafe levels of lead, in addition to hundreds and hundreds more that test results that showed levels of lead that were below the federal action level.
That's an interesting one because, as you said, this lead affects academic performance later on down the road. This is what schools are concerned about, is academic performance. So is this is your sense that this is something that is emerging at the top of the list when we talk about drinking water concerns?
I think so, personally, because it's one that is relatively unaddressed, and it's one that affects so many more people because you've got these very, very large municipal systems where, you know, with thousands of water customers, and very, very spotty testing that's required to pass, you know, muster with the lead and copper rule. And so that's really a federal requirement. We did not find that the state DNR was failing to enforce the federal lead and copper rule. What we found was that the federal lead and copper rule, which controls, is just really full of holes.
We're talking right now about the status of Wisconsin's drinking water and the risks in Wisconsin of water polluted by substances ranging from lead and nitrates to disease-causing bacteria and viruses. And investigative journalist Dee Hall is with us. She's managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the fact that in some parts of Wisconsin, the level of water pollutants exceeds that found in Flint? Not in all places, but we talked about some there. And what are your concerns about your own local drinking water? What actions would you like to see from the DNR, the state level, the federal level? And what do you think the problems are right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll be back in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're looking back at an investigation on the safety of Wisconsin's drinking water conducted by the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And Dee Hall is with us in studio. She's managing editor at the WCIJ. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think that Wisconsin is failing at the faucet? Are you concerned about water quality where you live or in the state in general? And who do you think should fix it? Who's responsible? Call 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And you can also send us a tweet. It's at Central Time WPR. And Dee, we were talking about the issue of schools testing for lead, and they are not apparently legally required at this time. But if they do test, they do find high levels of lead. Who's responsible for fixing it and for paying the bill?
Well, at this stage, the EPA has no requirements for testing. So schools don't have to test to begin with. If they do test, they don't have to tell anybody that they did it, although obviously that would be the right thing to do. And then even if they do find high levels of lead, they're not really required to do any remediation. Everything having to do with schools is voluntary. When it comes to daycares are required to mitigate any lead paint hazards that they have, but there's no lead in water testing that's required by the state of Wisconsin. The only exception there is, again, if there is a daycare center or a home that's on a private well, which are largely unregulated in our state and many states. In those cases, the daycare provider must test, but you have, you know, hundreds of daycare centers in Milwaukee that we know for sure are served by lead service lines, and they are not required to test. That is one of the projects that the city of Milwaukee is engaging in right now, is trying to go around to those nearly 400 sites and replace the lead service lines leading into the buildings.
And I suppose some daycare providers do take care of infants, and infants may eat formula.
Right.
Which is, you know, used mixed with water, and it could have come from a tap. I guess the question is that may have a lead surface line.
Right. And or even lead in the system. So the city of the Milwaukee Public Schools, they have told us that they have no lead service lines and never have had lead service lines leading to their schools. And yet here you have, you know, nearly 200 water faucets that have two levels of lead that are dangerous. So it gets into the system through the plumbing somehow. And so that shows that even not having a lead service line, you still can have a lead problem if some of your interior plumbing has a problem.
Let's go to our callers right now. We've got Clint on the line in Neenah. Clint, hi.
Hi. I was calling because we discovered we had a lead service line through blood in our, or actually a blood test of our child. So.
Sorry about that. So what happened next?
Well, basically what I had to do was go and find out exactly how to flush the line, which in our case, because it's a service line, it's, you know, about 100 feet a line, and it requires quite a few gallons of water first thing in the morning to flush the line. But we've got kind of a double whammy going on here because our house was built in 55, which means that they probably used lead solder as well.
It sounds like it's something you're still dealing with. Clint, thank you for that, and sorry about that discovery. And Clint, I'm sure, is not alone. A lot of people may not have tested like he did, but that's a situation you've been telling us about, Dee. What sorts of earmarks for older homes are there for people who are concerned?
Well, that's part of the problem is a lot of these things are not really right out in the open. You know, they are in walls. There are ways to test for lead. One is to take a coin and scratch any old pipes that you might have downstairs leading into your home and see if they end up being very shiny. If they're very shiny, it's possible that that's a lead service line. I would say if you're concerned about that and your home was built before about 1978, you should probably have a plumber take a look at it. A plumber can tell you how much, you know, which of your components have lead in them and how much lead and what you should do about it.
I was surprised when we talked earlier this year, Dee, about the city of Madison being a leader in the nation about replacing at least the service lines from the home to the city supply.
Right. What happened there was the city was out of compliance with the lead and copper rule. It was coming up with high lead levels in its tests, and there were some options. Corrosion control is one of them. But they found that the cost of putting phosphorus, which is used for corrosion control, into the system, they would then have to remove it at the end of the process at the wastewater treatment plant so that they didn't create even more pollution in our lakes here. And so it was somewhat of a clear-eyed kind of financial decision that turned out to be kind of a national model for what communities should do. Now, that said, it's a very, very expensive fix. Milwaukee is estimating that to remove all 70,000 lead service lines from the city would cost over $500 million with a B dollars. And so, yes, it's a very good thing to do, but that is what's happening right now as communities are struggling with this idea of this completely unanticipated, very high capital cost of removing lead from their systems.
We're talking with Dee Hall right now from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about the safety of Wisconsin's drinking water. And we'll go now to Connie in Portage. Connie, hi.
Hi. Well, I sort of have a solution, I think. Why don't the people get Culligan's reverse osmosis? I've had it for 25 years, and it removes everything from the water. I'm an RN, and I felt when I moved up here that we were on the lake, and I felt it was safer, and it's been wonderful. Why can't they use that?
Connie, thanks for that.
Yeah, and that is one of the recommendations. Places like Washington, D.C., which had about 12 years ago, they had a huge lead crisis. It was related to the corrosion control, again, being used by the city of Washington, D.C., and a lot of the homes there to this day continue to have filters. Filters are considered to be very effective if they are maintained properly, if you have the cartridges switched, if you use a cartridge system. The concern is that not everybody will be as diligent in replacing filters or in maintaining systems so that some lead can get in. So the permanent solution is considered to be removal of the lead components, but it is a very good temporary measure that a lot of places are using. I will also say that there are some schools in, I believe it is Baltimore and Washington, where they have a daily flushing of all the pipes and they have filters. So there are places that are taking this quite seriously.
So Connie was talking about a reverse osmosis system, which is a little more involved. Does something as simple as a Brita pitcher work?
For some situations, yes, and I'm not an expert in this area, but I do know that that's one thing that, for example, the city of Milwaukee did. They handed out a certain number of filters to people on lead service lines. They've run out of those already. And say they're going to start the program again in 2017.
And another story in this same series, you looked at the DNR getting some new directives about how to test from the EPA, and it seems as though they failed to pass them on for a series of, you know, almost 10 months. What happened there?
So this is a point at which the agency would disagree with us, but we reported that they did not directly pass on this information to the 11,000-plus water managers in the state of Wisconsin. They went to some seminars. They did some communication of this message, but not directly. And the reason we discovered this was very much through the back door. We were talking to some schools for our schools and daycare story, And they were not aware that they were not supposed to flush the water beforehand. And so there's something called pre-stagnation flushing. I'm hoping that's the last time I have to say that. But pre-stagnation flushing has to do with letting the water sit, you know, flushing the system and then letting it sit for 6 hours and taking samples. And that was a very common approach. But it also was found as a result of Flint to mask the true level of lead in water. But what we found through the course of our reporting was that water managers were not aware. They were supposed to have stopped doing that, and that was based on a directive from EPA back in February. It was passed along directly to the water managers the day that our story was posted.
So you say the DNR disagrees with you. What did they say about
They're delay? Saying that they took plenty of efforts, that their efforts were sufficient, and that, you know, that they were not required to pass this along, which is true. These are still, these are not requirements. These are guidances, but you know, clearly the guidance had a reason. The reason was that they found that the common, in some places, common practices were masking the true level of lead in water and that they should stop.
And Dee, in our last little bit of time together here, what is next on the horizon as Wisconsin considers the problems that you've outlined and the solutions?
Well, I think the Democrats will most likely in the upcoming session reintroduce some of these bills that would, more directly attack the problem of lead in drinking water.
The Democrats.
Water.
It's not a bipartisan issue?
Not right now. It doesn't seem to be. Now, I will say that, you know, whether Governor Walker will try to find some additional money for the lead pipe replacement program, that would be something. We haven't heard that, but I know that there is some desire there on the part of the administration to get some of these lead service lines out of the ground. So those are the two things I know of. We will continue to be writing about drinking water. We have some stories in the works.
Dee, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That was Dee Hall with us, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Coming up after the news, deciding to be kind to yourself can be one of the most important things you can do to keep yourself mentally and physically healthy. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickert. As many of us set goals for ourselves for the new year, we thought it was a good time to listen back to a favorite interview from earlier in 2016. When we mess up and we fail, most people have a tendency to dwell on their mistakes, but new research shows that we actually could benefit from a little kindness from ourselves, and learning to be kind to yourself can have a remarkable effect on happiness. Mark Leary joined us to talk about being kind to ourselves. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. He wrote an article for the online magazine Eon called Don't Beat Yourself Up. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, your piece about being kind to yourself, you start off by saying that humans are really the only animal that specializes in making themselves miserable. What do we know about why that is?
Well, human beings are the only animals that can think consciously about themselves. And so we can think about ourselves in negative ways. We can look into the future and begin to dread and worry about what's happening in ways that other animals can't. They react to the bad events that happen right in the moment. But as long as they're safe in their burrows, they're not lying there awake all night long the way that we are, tossing and turning in bed, worrying about the next day.
And why do people dwell on their mistakes?
Well, we really don't know, but we think it's probably because when you make a mistake, it's probably better to assume in one way that it's more serious than it really is. That is, it's better to take something very seriously than to overlook the possibility that you did something very negative or very badly and aren't paying attention to it. So we seem to have a built-in bias to be harder on ourselves than we really need to be, than we really need to be from a realistic sense. Things are usually not as bad as we think they are.
Mark, tell us about some of this research about why these days it seems like focusing on kindness to ourselves is supplanting what we used to think about having positive self-esteem.
Well, for many years, we believed that self-esteem was really important, which it is. People want to feel good about themselves and evaluate themselves positively. But it's much more important to treat yourself kindly and compassionately the way you would treat a loved one. The irony is, most of us are far meaner to ourselves in our own minds than we would ever be toward people that we care about. And it's just interesting to think about dealing with yourself the same way that you would deal with other people when they have problems, to reduce the blame and the criticism and the negativity. And if you do that, it produces the same kind of positive effects it produces on loved ones when we show them compassion.
Can we be specific about what it means to be kind to ourselves? I think I know what that means, but if I'm actually in that moment, what am I doing to be kind to myself?
You're simply being supportive. It's not positive thinking. It's not just saying everything is okay, you're a wonderful person, don't worry about anything. That's usually not what you say to loved ones who are having a problem. You're realistic with them. You talk about the problem as it really exists, but you don't let them exaggerate it. You don't let them catastrophize and turn it into something worse than it really is. The problems of life are bad enough as they are. And it's somewhat ironic that we beat ourselves up and make ourselves feel even worse about what's happened to us than we would have felt by the event itself happening. So it's just a matter of being compassionate and caring and kindness to yourself without minimizing the problems that you may have, because they really are there.
Mark Leary is with us right now. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. And we're talking about why research shows that being kind to ourselves is actually a lot more beneficial than being tough on ourselves. It has a good effect on our happiness and our sense of well-being. Let's take a caller now. We've got Zane joining us in Madison. Zane, hi.
Hello. It's great to be on there. I love this show. Super great when you do all these like positive uplifting moments.
Oh, thank you.
But yeah, this last summer I've been going through basically what this your guest has been talking about. Is I just went super down on myself. I was in a company that felt like they were constantly putting me down, and I personally felt like I was taking all this blame and that I was the kind of the cause of every issue going on. But they really loved me. Like anytime I brought up, oh, I feel like I'm being underappreciated, they would say, no, you're working really hard. There are some issues, but you are really valued. And it took me a long time this summer to just realize that everyone kind of sees you with your strengths, and you always see yourself as so weak. But it really helps to kind of just, even though there might be bad issues or bad problems, that you have strength, you are a good person, and that you can get through it eventually.
And so, Zane, do you feel like that made a difference in your sense of well-being and happiness when you were able to be nicer to yourself?
Oh, it's mind-opening when you realize, like, okay, I'm strong enough to get through whatever comes my way, basically. That you can always get away. There's always a new way around a different problem. Like, roadblocks always come up, but there's always an over, under, left, or right around the situation.
Great. Well, Zane, thank you so much, and thanks for the kind words about Central Time. And Mark, one takeaway from that call is that Zane was able to change his thinking. He was able to be kind to himself. Is that one of the strengths of this approach, is that it's not too hard to do to learn to be kind to ourselves?
At the most basic level, it's not too hard. And as I listened to Zane talk, it's exactly the kind of thing he would have said to a good friend who was having those same kinds of problems at work. He simply said them to himself. And when you think of it that way, it's not really that hard once you realize you don't have to beat yourself up. That was the turning point for me. It's like a light bulb went off, and I realized I don't have to be as negative toward myself as I have been my whole life. Should you get down on yourself now and then and be critical? Of course. Should you feel badly when you do bad things? Of course. The question is, how badly should you feel? And Zane's learned that he didn't have to feel as badly as he was making himself feel previously.
What do we know about why this is better than focusing on self-esteem? Because that used to be the big thing, as you write about. It used to be there was even, you know, government money going toward increasing people's self-esteem. So why didn't that work as well as this works?
Because once you feel badly about yourself and you have low self-esteem, it's very hard to prop that up artificially. If you really negatively evaluate yourself, it takes a lot of work to evaluate yourself more positively. It's much easier to be kind to yourself, because you can be kind to yourself even if you don't like yourself very much. Even if your self-esteem is low, you can treat yourself well and treat yourself with caring and concern, just like you can treat other people you don't like very well. You don't have to like them and hold them in high esteem. You can still treat them with compassion and caring and kindness, and you can do the same thing for yourself. So self-compassion or self-kindness is more applicable for everybody, because you don't have to start out at a point where you're already feeling good about yourself.
Are we basically talking about self-talk here? So if I've screwed up and I feel bad, I made a bad decision, is it basically the way that I talk to myself, or is it things like treating myself? I'm going to let myself go to bed early and I'm going to have a cup of tea. Which is it? Is it talk or actionable stuff?
I would say it's both. And if you think about how we treat other people who are going through a hard time, we'll say things to them. We'll talk to them in a way that's kind and caring. But we also might suggest we'll go to bed earlier, or let's go out and get a drink and talk about this, or treat yourself to ice cream today. So it's both the way we talk to ourselves in our own mind, and it's the nice things we do to ourselves. This really came out with a student I was working with who had come back from a visit with her grandparents. And they were getting elderly, they were forgetting things, they weren't able to get around as they could. And her grandfather beat himself up awful. He just agonized over not being able to do what he used to do. But her grandmother just naturally had self-compassion. And she would say things like, when I get up and I realize that it's going to be a rough day for me with my arthritis, I treat myself special that day. I take better care of myself, which is exactly, again, what you would do for a friend. You wouldn't just scream at your friend for not forgetting where the car keys are or not being able to walk across the room in a steady way. So it's talk and action.
Let's take another call now. We've got Paul on the line with us from Wausau. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Thank you for the guest. I wanted to say that I've recently gone through a pretty difficult time, and discovering that I have the choice to be kind to myself has been very beneficial. I came about that discovery through some literature, Mindfulness for Beginners and the Four Agreements, and I'd like to get your guest's opinion on mindfulness and the correlation that it has with his literature.
Thank you, Paul, for that question. Is there a correlation between mindfulness, a sort of meditation, and being kind to yourself?
Absolutely, because people who practice mindfulness quiet down a lot of this internal chatter that is often very unkind to us. And in fact, the researcher who first started the study of self-compassion about 10 years ago, it's Dr. Kristen Neff at the University of Texas, explicitly connects self-compassion with the practice of mindfulness, and it's one way to get there. And she says that self-compassionate people are naturally more mindful. They're more attuned to their current situation without judgment and without a lot of self-talk. They just accept the moment as it is, and that's one route. There are other ways to be self-compassionate, but one way is just to accept what's here without a whole lot of internal commentary about it.
We're listening back to a conversation we had with Mark Leary earlier this year about why learning to be kind to yourself can have remarkable health benefits. He is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're continuing a conversation we had in 2016 with Mark Leary about how being kind to yourself can be beneficial to your physical and your mental well-being. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. And we go to our callers now. Katie is first in Madison. Hi, Katie.
My first thought when you began the show was, I'm 63, and so I was brought up at a time when at home and in school where it was thought that if you did something wrong, raking you over the coals was the correct action to make you feel horrible so you wouldn't do it again. And, as I've grown over the years and had to evolve from that. I do remember having to make that transition from thinking how stupid I was every time I did something wrong and, you know, going into it's not so bad. So, you know, I have this little dialogue going in my head. And now it's I kind of amuse myself sometimes because I as I'm going through something, I'm thinking of, oh, well, I could be reacting to, you know, this thing that I did and telling myself what an idiot I am. But I'm not because I realize at my age it's not the end of the world to make a mistake. It's, you know, I'm going to make a lot of mistakes and that's okay and, you know, life will go on.
Interesting, Katie. Yeah, so that's a great point. And Mark, is there something to that, that it used to be sort of more the cultural norm that that was how you learned your lessons? You made yourself suffer and feel bad about it.
Absolutely. And there are plenty of people today who still subscribe to that idea. And I think it's because we're afraid that we're not going to act the way we should. We're going to misbehave, or our kids are going to misbehave unless we really come down on them extremely hard. And, of course, people have to be corrected. There's nothing wrong with parents getting on their kids for, you know, for misbehaving or even making mistakes. The question is, how harsh do you need to be on other people, and how harsh do you need to be for yourself? We did a study a few years ago trying to understand people who actively resist the idea that you should be self-compassionate. But there's nothing incompatible with having really high standards, but yet finding that sweet spot of how badly do I need to feel in order to keep me on track. And my sense is that most of us go overboard. We assume we have to be much harder on ourselves than we really do, and we can still keep ourselves in line and achieve and do excellent things and be moral people with a lot less chastisement of ourselves, a lot less self-denigration.
Now, in your piece, you talk about how there are both physical and mental markers of well-being that are associated with being kind to ourselves. What is the science out there?
Well, in terms of emotion, every study that's been done on self-compassion, and there are dozens now, show that people who are more self-compassionate are happier, they're more satisfied with their lives, they have less anxiety, less depression, less negative emotions in general, they cope better with situations that arise. And I think for most of us, that's what we would like to have in life. Bad things are going to happen, to be sure. But if we stop layering on extra self-recrimination and negative emotion, then life will seem better. Physically, there's evidence that anytime you reduce negative emotion and stress, it's better for the body. I mean, there's no question about that. So if you go through life beating yourselves up and upset with yourself chronically, you're going to have worse health than someone who takes things more in stride and has a little more equanimity.
Now, you were participating, you were working with a group of HIV patients and this idea of self-compassion, and there were some pretty striking differences in these patients and how they worked with themselves. What did you find?
We found not only that the people who were HIV positive, who were more self-compassionate, were coping better with having such a potentially dangerous disease. And they were coping better because they weren't adding, again, those extra layers of shame and self-criticism on top of the fact that they had an illness. But it also seemed to alleviate their concerns about talking about it with other people. So the individuals who were higher in self-compassion talked about being HIV positive more openly with their healthcare providers. They let other people know because that sense of stigma and shame and self-recrimination just wasn't as high.
Let's take another caller now. We've got Ryan on the line with us in Watertown. Hi, Ryan.
So I've been dealing with this probably like the early 90s. It's just something that you kind of grow up. Some people can get through it by learning to be happier, the positive attitude kind of aspect of it. But, you know, I don't know, growing up in my household, it's more like a one-strike system where you do one bad thing because you want to please people. And then after you do something wrong, you really get down on yourself, and then it just keeps getting worse and worse. And now that I'm in my almost 30s, the attitude or trying to fight these thoughts, if you will, are harder to break. But one of my therapists has really helped me recently with this system that seemed almost childish to me, but it really works. What it basically is whenever I have a negative thought or start getting down myself, I write these like four categories. There's four squares, if you will. Kind of the first off with the negative feeling that I'm having, and then there's different categories of what attitude it is or what negative feeling it pertains to. And then also, in a third one, kind of defend those positive or try to fight back the negative thoughts with what I did good.
Ryan, thank you so much for sharing that. And so, Ryan, he said these patterns of being tough on himself and having other people be tough on him were really hard to break. But with some therapy, it sounds like some specific techniques, he was able to learn this habit. How hard is it to pick up this habit once you've sort of learned the other one, Mark?
It's a challenge, I can say just personally, to make that sort of switch. The key thing is awareness, and what he really expressed there is being aware and attentive to the times in which you are being harsher on yourself, meaner to yourself, than you would be on other people. And just to be alert to that fact, and then to stop yourself and say, I wouldn't treat someone else this way. Why would I treat myself this way? Someone once said that if we treated other people the way we treat ourselves in our own heads, that we would be arrested for assault because we are sometimes so negative to ourselves in our heads. It's awareness and monitoring and keeping track of how we're talking to ourselves.
And just briefly, we're just about out of time, but I realize you're the researcher here. Have you tried this yourself?
I have struggled with being self-critical my whole life, and I was proud of it. I think a lot of people who are self-critical are proud of, I hold myself to high standards. But when you realize that you're making yourself miserable, then you realize it's not so cool anymore, and you decide, I don't have to be that harsh. I can still have high standards and be a good person without beating myself up.
That was Mark Leary, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. He joined us to talk about how being kind to yourself can have a positive effect on your happiness and your health. Now, one of our favorite Wisconsin Life segments from the last year. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Horan Riley always wanted to be an actor. He found a way to live his dream as part of Encore Studios, a theater company for people with disabilities. Riley spoke to me using one of his favorite voices on his communication device.
I began acting when I was 18 years old. When I was still in high school. Although I don't remember the play, but I do remember I loved it.
When I first met you, which is now 16 years ago, I believe you mentioned that you always wanted to be an actor.
That's Kelsey Schanauer, the founder and executive and artistic director of Encore Studios in Madison. Encore is the only professional theater company for people with disabilities in Wisconsin.
I've always loved movies. And I wanted to tell stories. Acting was the best way I could think of.
So that's always been a big part of your life and always a big desire. And so when you came to us, you know, we were thrilled to welcome you. And there's a lot of just great innate ability and a really amazing presence. I think your first role, the first full-scale production that you were in, you made the front page of the Wisconsin State Journal, so... I know I didn't in the first thing I've done. When was that? That was 2001. That was To Love or Not to Love.
Corin is a Madison native. He joined Encore 16 years ago.
My favorite part of acting is to be able to perform for people I care about.
He's since acted in more than 40 productions in all kinds of roles.
We do 3 plays locally. And those plays are all original full-scale productions.
My favorite role was playing the character Colin in the play Real Life. I was lucky enough to be able to perform with my friend John Meister.
Real Life was something that I did write for, kind of for myself and for the other actors. And it is focusing on high-functioning autism. And it gives a very interesting, varied perspective on that really important issue that's becoming much more in the forefront these days.
How does he get in the head of his characters?
Rehearse, 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 and then rehearse some more.
There's still a number of roles on his bucket list.
Romantic scenes are my favorite. However, I don't get to play them very often. I would love to play the role of the wolf. in Stephen Sondheim's musical, Into the Woods. I like playing mean characters. It's a lot of fun.
Corin Reilly is an actor in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Day yesterday, I slept in, I went bowling, and I almost finished the book I was reading. All of this happened inside, where it was nice and warm. But thousands of people in Milwaukee showed up yesterday at Bradford Beach for the Polar Bear Plunge, the New Year's tradition of plunging into frigid Lake Michigan. About 500 people actually made the plunge. The rest were just there to watch. And if you were brave enough to take that plunge yesterday in Milwaukee, it was the day to do it. Temperatures hit 40 degrees, making it kind of toasty, at least relatively speaking. And we had a conversation in the office this morning talking about why people choose voluntarily to do this. And the answer is we're really not sure. One polar bear plunger interviewed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel said it was like a cleanse. And another one said he liked the adrenaline rush. Well, here's what it sounded like. Well, okay, it kind of sounds like fun, but still, for me, there is no way. What about you? Would you ever consider plunging into a lake in the middle of a Wisconsin winter? Have you done it? If so, let us know. At Central Time, WPR is our Twitter handle, and you can also let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.